Welcome, friends, to the Health Ranger Show. I'm your host, Mike Adams, the Health Ranger, the editor of naturalnews.com. And one of the issues that we've been covering that has garnered a tremendous amount of interest, especially from moms, people worried about the health of their children, is the issue of vaccines. Are vaccines really safe and effective? What about the autism link with vaccines? And what evidence is there really about vaccines that these doctors keep trying to push on us? Now, to help us answer some of those questions is the author of a fantastic book that's about to be published. It's called Saying No to Vaccines. It's a resource guide to all ages. Her name is Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, and she's the president of the board of the American Association for Health Freedom, which you'll find online at healthfreedom.net. And Sherry, thanks for joining us on the show today.
Thank you so much for having me. It's a pleasure.
Now, where do we begin with this issue? Your position is that a lot of the pro-vaccine doctors out there or health authorities pushing it really don't know what they're talking about. How do we begin to get our hands around this issue?
I think that we need to start from the history. I'm a really big history buff, and I'm a really big believer that if you don't learn the lessons from history, you're bound to repeat them. And if we go back to 1853, which was the first mandatory vaccination laws that were passed in the UK, when you start to see that at that point in time is where things started to roll forward and be gelled in this country, I think that that gives us a backdrop of why we are where we are, and perhaps understanding the history of that, we could do things differently going forward. Well, in 1853 was the first mandatory vaccination law that was passed, and at the same time, there was a growing anti-vaccination movement and a growing alternative medicine movement that arose in response to that. In 1853, the anti-vaccinationists put together a group, and they were called Our Babies Battle. And what they were doing with that was they were fighting to stop all the vaccination that was happening at that time. And of course, in 1853, the only vaccine that was being used was the smallpox vaccine. However, once they started using mandatory vaccination, there was more vaccine out in the community. The smallpox rate went up. People were dying of gangrene and all sorts of terrible things that were happening from this vaccine. They were saying that we should not be injecting dead animal parts and all these vile sorts of things into our young children. Well, when you roll forward now to 2008, we are continuing to do the same thing. We are injecting vile things into our children, things like aluminum, 2-phenoxyethanol, formaldehyde, and a litany of animal parts that we're still doing this and causing a disruption of problems.
Let me stop you right there, because some people listening to this are going to say, what? What are you talking about? These are just vaccines. These are just pharmaceuticals. They couldn't contain animal parts. What are you talking about? Can you clarify that?
Just to give your listeners a little bit of a background on me, I'm an osteopathic physician. I'm a board certified medical doctor that I've been in my own practice since 1985. When I started in what I call my first life or my first career, I was an emergency medicine physician, and I was the director of an emergency department here in Ohio for about 12 years. All of that time in my medical training and background and education, I always thought that the only thing that was in any vaccine was a little sterile water, a little dead virus or a little dead bacteria, and that was it. I had no idea until September of 2000, when I attended the National Vaccine Information Center meeting, that there was something else in those vaccines and something worth questioning or something worth even investigating. When I started looking as simply as looking at the package inserts of the vaccines and started finding out that many of them are made from cow serum, kidney monkey cells, chicken embryos, dog cells, human embryo cells, chicken mouse brain cells. I had no idea that all of those things were in vaccines.
Whoa, this sounds unbelievable to someone who's new to this. I mean, kidney parts from monkeys, cells from mouse brains? Now, come on, why do they put these in vaccines?
Well, they're not exactly put into vaccines. It's not as if you had like a test tube and you were dropping in these cells and you were creating a formulation. What actually happens is that a lot of the viruses, like, for example, the polio virus, needs to grow on a particular type of cell and multiply in order to harvest those viruses, treat them with a chemical to inactivate them. So polio viruses are grown on African green monkey cells. There are a variety of different vaccines that have to be grown with cow serum. The monkey monkey, the mouse brains, those are like, the, I believe it's the rabies vaccine. And so they put those viruses in those. Now, when they extract those viruses out, little bits of those cells, residual cells, actually remain in the vaccine that gets injected into your body.
So you're getting parts of these cells from various animals.
You're not getting parts of the cells. You're actually getting the cells.
Entire cells.
Yeah, from those animals. In fact, CBER, which is the branch of the FDA that looks at vaccine contaminants, they meet several times a year talking about animal cell contaminants in vaccines, and is there a real concern there? They also talk about the other types of viruses that end up in those vaccines, like chicken-type viruses, bovine or cow-type viruses that end up to be contaminants in those vaccines. And there are certain scientists at the FDA that are very, very concerned that we are injecting cow viruses and chicken viruses into the human genome in the human body, and they're very concerned about the potential of what kind of health ramifications that is having on us.
But of course, they don't have the voice at the FDA. It's the top-level bureaucrats who are making decisions in favor of the drug companies, it seems. Because let's face it, vaccination is a big, big business. So much in medicine depends on it.
So much of medicine does depend on it, Mike. In fact, I've been saying for many years, I've been speaking out about this since about 2001, and I actually even was able to get into the public record at the CDC. In 2002, I spoke at the CDC in Atlanta and a town meeting in St. Louis in the same year when they were trying to make them reinstitute mandatory smallpox vaccination across the country. And it is a very big business, and I've been saying for all of these years that the vaccine industry is the foundation. It's in the DNA of the medical industry. It's the backdrop and the foundation historically, which goes back to the history we spoke of earlier, and that we put this umbrella out there about vaccines and public health. All the damage that vaccines can cause is like the business loss leader in the industry. I'm sure a lot of your listeners have businesses, and a business loss leader is sort of like, you know, come in and get your free T-shirt, and oh, by the way, while you're here, we'll sell you a $500 suit, you know. And so a business loss leader is like that, and the vaccines are sold for much less money and make a lot less money for the industry than what, say, Lipitor does. But once the children or the adults get injured or ill from the effects of the vaccines, the real money is all the drugs that go after that in the pharmaceutical industry to take care of those injuries.
That's a very strong statement, and I've actually made many of those same statements very similar to that. But can you support this some more? Because the idea is that vaccinations really are a recruiting tool. And I think not just physically, not just in terms of a person's biology, but also psychologically, because once a patient commits to getting a shot, then they believe that that is the modality through which they must attain health. It makes them easier for them to agree to chemotherapy, for example, or other pharmaceuticals. Would you agree with that?
That's a good analogy. I would agree with that. I think that there's two kinds of mindsets in a general patient. I mean, I see it in my office practice here in Cleveland all the time, is that you either have patients who, it's a belief system. It goes back to what we were talking about earlier in terms of a belief system. They believe in conventional medicine, or they believe that there are other ways to get health. Quite frankly, I believe that true integrative medicine, which is the type of medicine that I practice, it cherry picks the best from both sides of that equation. I mean, certainly there are times when we need surgery, and if we've broken a bone, we need an orthopedist, or, you know, there are times when we're really sick, we do need an antibiotic. But certainly there are other tools in the toolbox that can work towards health in a much better way. And I think that sometimes when people start going down the path, they really believe that these vaccines are safe, they're going to protect them, and once you get a vaccine, it will keep you from getting sick. And that's simply not true.
And I want to ask you, as we continue this show, I want to ask you about the marketing of vaccines and how they use fear factors to effectively market it. I want to ask you about the illusion of protection. And isn't it interesting that people, they psychologically feel like they're protected even when they're not. And there's really a kind of vaccine quackery going on that typically the critics of alternative medicine might say, what's going on with homeopathy? But if you look at vaccinations, it's the same kind of logic going on there that, you know, oh, if I got sick, then the vaccine must have helped me. If I didn't get sick, the vaccine must have protected me too. And then finally, when we come back, I want to ask you about why children who are vaccinated tend to contract infectious disease at higher rates than children who are not vaccinated. So we're going to continue with that when we come back with this exclusive interview with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. Her website is sayingnotovaccines.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back here on the Health Ranger Show. Welcome back to the Health Ranger Show, friends. We are continuing an exclusive interview with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the author of Saying No to Vaccines, a resource guide to all ages. This is a book, a brand new book, that will give you the evidence to refute the pro-vaccination quackery that's out there, where these doctors are saying, take vaccines. Why? Because we've always given them. Not because there's any science behind it, just because it's something they've always done. Now, let's talk about that, Sherry, the quackery of vaccinations, because it seems like they're really promoting these vaccines based on circular reasoning, and there's not really any evidence behind it. Is that an accurate position, or what would you say about that?
Well, what I would say is that vaccination is promoted to say, and you hear it all the time, that vaccines are safe, they're effective, they protect you, and they cause no harm. And in my book, I refute each one of those positions. And what I tried to do in the book was to make this be a resource manual so you can go down and find the question that you're most interested in finding an answer to. So you can pick and choose from the questions you want to know. You can go to that section. You can read what's refuted. And everything that I say is documented from conventional medical literature to support your right to say no and your reasons that you might want to refuse vaccines. The other thing that I've done with it is the book is going to be bound in an easy open mechanism so that you can lay it on a copying machine, copy out just those pages that you want to take to your pediatrician to show that this is what I've been talking about, that vaccines aren't safe. Getting back to your question, Mike, when they say about vaccines are safe, there is some foolery, in my opinion, and that's just my own word, about how they decide that vaccines are safe. It's very small populations. The side effect profile is studied for a very short period of time, usually 14 days or less from the time of the shot, sometimes as long as 30 days, but that's not very often. And so the long-term ramifications on health are really not known, and if something shows up later, they simply negate it by saying it has nothing to do with the vaccine.
So they're only really looking for side effects for a couple of weeks, but of course, conditions like autism or autoimmune disorders, they can take a lot longer than that to develop from the vaccine shot, right?
Absolutely, because of the immune system disruption. And I think that it's very important to understand some of the numbers behind vaccines, because I think that one of the main reasons that we're seeing so much vaccine injury now, and interestingly enough, I did a Google search the other day to find out what the incidence of autism was worldwide. And the World Health Organization is now estimating that one in 250 children worldwide are affected by autism. And that they're estimating that that's increasing by 20% per year. And what we're actually seeing is that there's so many vaccines now that are given that weren't given before. Because I hear this a lot from patients, and the question comes up. They say, well, you know what? My kids are teenagers. I really don't remember them getting that many shots. And the truth of the matter is they didn't. As recently as 1985, the only vaccines that were available were MMR, the DPT, and the polio vaccine. And each one of those antigens, the measles, mumps, and rubella, those are three separate vaccines, even though they're administered in one shot. The DPT, those are three separate vaccines administered in one shot. So when you add up all those individual vaccines, in 1985, kids got 33 vaccine antigens by the time they started kindergarten. Now, in 2008, if children get every recommended vaccine, they will now get 113 vaccine antigens by the time they enter kindergarten, and more than 150 by the time they're in junior high.
Well, what's interesting about this is that there is apparently no limit. There is no point at which these pro-vaccine pushers are going to say, that's too many. I mean, what's the limit? Could it be recommended that a child be given 1,000 vaccines? Apparently so.
Well, actually, Dr. Paul Offit, who's head of CHOP, Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, the Department of Pediatrics, actually wrote an article several years ago that actually said that, and I actually wrote a rebuttal to it, that he was saying children could take as many as 1,000 vaccines and it wouldn't hurt them.
You're kidding me.
No, I'm serious. I can actually show you where that article was actually written, and he was, and that up to, and so my point in my rebuttal to him was, If children could take 1,000 vaccines, why do we even need to bother? I mean, if their immune systems are so strong that they could handle that, then their immune systems are strong enough to handle any type of bug or virus that gets thrown at them by the general community. What's the point? So, but your point of saying that there seems to be no end, there is sadly a lot of truth to that. There are more than 20 vaccines right now in the developmental pipeline just for teenagers. I mean, we've recently added, in the last 2 years, we've added hepatitis A, pox booster, an MMR booster, a pertussis booster, a college meningitis shot, the new Gardasil vaccine, and we're now giving flu shots annually. I mean, and the reason that all of those go into children is because if the pharmaceutical industry can get them approved for use in children, they are protected from all liability by the injury compensation program. So they want all these given to kids so that they don't have any liability when the bad side effects occur.
Now, this is an important point to fully describe to the listeners here, that Big Pharma has already been granted basically immunity for the side effects caused by vaccines, correct?
That is correct.
And when was this legislation put into place, and what's the reasoning behind that?
The legislation was actually signed into actual law by President Reagan in 1986. It's called the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act. It started because in 1984 there were so many lawsuits against the pharmaceutical industry because of the problems that were happening with the whole cell pertussis vaccine. They were having so many lawsuits that they said that the pharmaceutical industry said, unless you protect us, government, we are going to stop making vaccines altogether. And if we stopped, all of these horrible things would happen to all of these people, because remember what I said, vaccination is in the DNA fabric of medicine. It's all there. And so they went to the Congress and said, you have to pass the law to protect us. So in 1986, the National Vaccine Injury Compensation Act was put into place. Part of that Injury Compensation Act was something called the Vaccine Injury Compensation Program. How it was originally designed was that if you received a vaccine and you were injured from that vaccine, you were to be able to apply to the government through a fund that was funded by the sale of vaccines, a tax on the sale of vaccines, for compensation because you had sacrificed yourself or your child for the greater good. And the vaccine program was able to continue in this country for the greater good. But what has happened is it's become very adversarial, and less than 25% of persons who are injured and apply for money actually get compensation. And there are more than 5,000 children right now lined up to go through this program because of the connection between vaccines and autism. And it is estimated that the injury compensation, or the VAERS database that registers all of these side effects, gets more than 12,000 reports of injuries per year.
So the drug companies managed to sidestep this whole issue of being responsible for the side effects of their vaccines, and they essentially managed to make the customers pay for the damage caused to customers, whereas the drug companies get to keep all the profits and have none of the liability. That's a pretty clever kind of con right there.
But don't you wish you could come up with a business model like that?
Yeah, if I were dishonest and evil and didn't care about human beings, I'm sure I'd be in the pharmaceutical industry because they make so much money.
It wouldn't have been great to have come up with a business model that you have 750,000 people working for you called doctors, that you don't have to pay them any money, you don't have to provide benefits, no holidays, no vacation, no anything, no retirement plan, no anything. And the doctors are walking around handing out little white pieces of paper called prescriptions, making you $500 billion a year. I mean, what a great model.
All right, folks, we're going to continue with that when we come back with this exclusive interview with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. Her website is sayingnotovaccines.com. Stay with us. We'll be right back here on the Health Ranger Show. Welcome back to the Health Ranger Show, folks. I think you're probably enjoying this interview as much as I am, because we're talking to Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the author of a new book called Saying No to Vaccines. This is a book you've got to check out. By the way, Sherry, can people find that on Amazon.com, or is it only available through you? How do they get that book?
Yes, it's available on Amazon.com. It's also available through our website on sayingnotovaccines.com.
Okay, so folks, go to her website, sayingnotovaccines.com. Check out her books. You also have a number of articles and other supporting information on that website as well. So, folks, check that out. You will definitely enjoy that. Now, the question I have for you, Sherry, is, by the way, is it okay if I call you Sherry instead of Dr. Tenpenny?
Absolutely. That's perfectly fine. I was Sherry a long time before I was Dr. Tenpenny, so that's fine with me, Mike. Thank you for asking.
It's great to be on a first-name basis with people like you who are making such a positive difference in this industry. My question to you is about health freedom and this trend, this very disturbing trend we're witnessing in the United States today about mandatory vaccinations and the criminalization of parents who are choosing to protect their children from vaccines. We're seeing threats. We're seeing parents being threatened with jail time, with being taken away from their children if they do not submit to these mandatory vaccinations. This is a serious issue. What are your thoughts on that, Sherry?
That's a great topic, and it deserves a lot of attention. For one thing, parents need to know all 50 states have vaccination exemptions, which means that once you've done your homework, if you decide that you do not want to have your children to have vaccines or have any more vaccines, and if they've already started the series, it's perfectly okay and very safe to just stop. The vaccine exemptions, all 50 states have a medical exemption. All states except West Virginia and Mississippi have a religious exemption, and there are 19 states that have a philosophical exemption, which means you've done your homework, you truly understand the risks of the vaccine and the risk of getting the infection. You've decided that the risk of the vaccine is greater than the risk of the infection, and you're going to choose other ways to keep yourself and your family happy, healthy, other than using vaccines. I detail that a lot in the book. There's another place where you can go and get your state law, which is the National Vaccine Information Center, which that website is nvic.org, nvic.org, that you can click on the button on the homepage that says exemptions and go right to the table that shows you what your state law is. But everyone has the right to choose so far. Mandatory vaccination has been coming down the road for a while.
If a parent chooses this route of claiming that they don't want vaccines for their children, if they take this route, will they be able to get their children into public schools, or is that still a problem?
No, that is exactly why what the exemptions are there for is about admission into public school. Now, in my book, and the reason that the subtitle of the book is A Resource Guide for All Ages, is because there are many other types of exemption requests that have come across my plate, things like healthcare workers who want to avoid the annual flu shot or the TB test, about people in the military, is there a way for them to avoid vaccines? When people are adopting children from outside the country, is there a way that they can work differently with the vaccination requirements? So all of my book really is really for all ages. We spend an awful lot of time talking about vaccination in children, and one of the things that must be kept in mind is that just because you're older, meaning 8 years old or 80 years old, it doesn't necessarily mean that the vaccine is any safer. I've seen many adults who have been injured and on permanent disability from hepatitis B vaccines, from flu shots, from yellow fever vaccines, and a variety of different travel vaccines. So vaccines can cause damage at any age.
Now, why is there so much belief in this whole system of vaccination? It's like when you go to talk to a pro-vaccine health so-called authority, and you even question the idea that vaccinations are safe and effective, it's almost as if you were questioning Darwin's theory of natural selection or the presence of gravity or something. People freak out. These doctors freak out, and they think they just dismiss it. They say, you can't even begin to question that. There's not even a discussion, period. Vaccinations are accepted, and that's the end of that discussion. Why does that happen? Why is there such stonewalling on this issue?
Well, if we go back to what we were talking about at the beginning of this interview about the 1853 first mandatory vaccination act that was passed in the UK, the first mandatory vaccination act in this country, I believe, was in around 1902. And what was happening at that time? Think about the medical industry at that time. There was not standardized medical education as we know it today. There were about 19 different licensing bodies as a way that you could become a physician. You were called either a physician, a medical doctor, an apothecary, or a surgeon. You could buy your license. You could do it as an apprentice. really could get it through a university, but they didn't have standardized medical education like we know it. So when vaccines started to evolve at that period of time, it was the first public health measure that came into play where physicians felt like they could really actively do something, and they really believed that this was a way to control smallpox. And it was the first methodology that physicians could get their hands around, number one, under the thought that it was really going to help people, and number two, as a way to make more money. And so that's why I say that this whole vaccination industry and thought and religion is really part of the foundational DNA of the entire profession. So when you question and challenge your physician about vaccination, you're questioning, like what you said, Darwin's theory, or questioning, is there really a God, or does the sun really rise in the east? You're questioning some of the most basic integral parts of what physicians have come to believe is true.
Well, let me explore this a little further with you, if that's okay. A doctor is going to say, well, of course vaccines work because they inject these weakened viruses, which causes an immune system response, which offers the side effect of immunity against the full-blown strong virus. So why does that not work? What's wrong with that theory?
Well, the premise is that we can trick the immune system by injecting these viruses or viral particles or bacterial particles, and we will develop something called an antibody. And the mere presence of that antibody is going to protect you from getting sick. And it doesn't. And the vaccine literature actually even states in very clear language that there is not a clear correlation between the presence of an antibody and protection from getting sick. So there was an assumption that was made that if they inject this particle into your body and your body develops an antibody, therefore you are immune and not get sick. But that's simply not true.
All right, so they equated the presence of the antibodies with immunity. But it turns out that immunity is very complex, a lot more complex than just the presence of some biochemical element. It's really an adaptive response that happens at many, many levels in your body, correct?
Absolutely, and it's more than just the presence of an antibody, because there are so many reported cases out there of large groups of people that are fully vaccinated with one or two different vaccines. Like, for example, the mumps outbreak that happened in Iowa a couple of years ago. They found that something like 67 to 70% of the children that came down with mumps had two MMR vaccines. There are chickenpox failure vaccines. There are measles outbreaks that happen in fully vaccinated populations. And so there are the flu that happens every year, and then they say, well, it was a poor match. I mean, it's just a bunch of excuses.
It's just quackery.
Well, it's very difficult to prove a negative. For example, if you get a flu shot and you don't get sick, was it the flu shot? Or was it that you really weren't exposed to the influenza virus? Or if you were exposed to it, was your body's immune system was just strong enough that it just blew it out and didn't do anything with it? How can you actually prove that it was because of that vaccine? You really can't. And so that's sort of one of those false premises that we make an assumption that the only way, and this is the other part, the assumption of the medical profession is that the only way that you're going to keep from getting sick is by giving you a vaccine. And if you don't get the vaccine, everybody that's exposed will get sick. And that's just a false premise.
Oh, yeah, that's complete nonsense, because the body has the ability to resist all kinds of infections. If it didn't, none of us would have survived past the first week from childbirth. So, all right, we're going to have to take a break here, Sherry, but we'll come back after this break right here on the Health Ranger Show with more of this exclusive interview with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, the author of Saying No to Vaccines. Stay with us. We'll be right back. Welcome back, friends, to the Health Ranger Show, where we are talking about vaccinations and whether they're safe or effective, or perhaps it's just a lot of quackery pushed by a system of medicine that really depends on vaccines to recruit patients for future treatments. Sounds outrageous, but if you look at the facts, you may find yourself curious about some of the new things you'll learn about what's really true on vaccines. So check out this book. It's called Saying No to Vaccines. And you'll find information about that online, too, at this website, sayingnotovaccines.com. The website and the book are both authored by Dr. Sherry Tenpenny, who's also the president of the board of the American Association for Health Freedom, the AAHF, which you'll find online at healthfreedom.net. Now, Sherry, someone who is adequately informed about this issue is at some point undoubtedly going to say, okay, I don't want to poison my children with these vaccines. The risk is too high, the benefits are not proven, and so on. What then should they do? They don't want their children to be vulnerable to infections in public schools, for example. What action steps can they take then that are natural and supportive of the body to help boost their child's immunity?
Well, that's a great question, Mike, and it's something that comes up all the time. And it's really simple things that everybody can do with their children or with their own body to keep themselves healthy. Simple things like avoiding white sugar, white flour, washing your hands frequently, not obsessively, but frequently when you've been out in public places. One of the things that I talk to my patients about a lot in the office is getting your kids to bed on time. We don't seem to enforce the bedtime as much as like when I was growing up. I mean, you see these little kids out at the mall and different places at like 8, 9 o'clock at night, and they're just exhausted. And there's so much science out there that actually shows that it's so important for children to get 10 to 11 hours of sleep at night to keep their immune system strong. And if you're feeding them good food, trying to eat organic as much as you can, staying away from McDonald's and all the trans fats, trying to avoid white sugar, white flour, and instead substitute healthy snacks, things like, you know, bananas and oranges and apple slices and things that will really take, will really be good for them. Get them away from their computer and get them away from their Game Boys and PlayStations and get them outside, make them run and play and just really exercise their immune systems. It's that simple to keep healthy. Taking a good quality multivitamin, drinking plenty of fresh purified water. And the problem with reason that people, it's so simple that people can't believe that that's really true, but it's because we've been so indoctrinated by the pharmaceutical industry, because the pharmaceutical industry can't create a $5 billion industry off of something that simple.
You know, I've given this a lot of thought, and I've even started writing a special report on this, and I'd like to share it with you. And it basically says that, you know, infection is not caused by the presence of a virus. Certainly, that is one necessary element for an infection, but it is not the primary determining factor. Infection is caused by an opportunistic failure of the host, the failure of the terrain, so to speak. It is the host that determines whether an infection occurs, not the presence of a virus. This mindset of just trying to kill viruses and focus on the virus and have no attention given to the health of the patient is, frankly, it's outdated. It's outmoded. It should be in a museum somewhere and not being practiced today.
Well, that, there's two comments I want to make about that, Mike, because you're absolutely right. One is it's a history lesson again, because it goes back to the debate between Pasteur and Beauchamp. You know, Pasteur was, it's all about the bug, and it's all this bugs, and we got to kill the bugs, and we need antibiotics to keep the bugs away, we need antiseptics, blah, 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 about the bug. And Pasteur, who was his competitor at the time, said, no, it's about the terrain. It's all about the terrain. It's about the health of the body. For example, if you have an apple that's sitting on the counter, and the skin of the apple is fully intact, it can sit there for a couple of weeks before it starts to break down and deteriorate. However, you take that same apple, you drop it on the floor, the bruise on the side, it's within a matter of a couple of days that now that integrity or the terrain of that apple is no longer intact and the bugs start to invade it. And what are the bugs there for but to like clean up the mess? And I published another book 2 years ago that came out in 2006, and the title of the book is called Foul, Bird Flu, It's Not What You Think. And really that book is, it's 17 chapters or 18 chapters, and probably 10 of those chapters are about the problems with the flu shot and about the whole influenza pandemic scare. And bird flu is still out there. It's just not in our mainstream media. I still get the alerts for it. But the last chapter of pulling it all together is just exactly about that, Mike. It's about the health of the terrain, and that if we keep our terrain healthy by all those suggestions, we really don't have a lot to fear.
Isn't it also true that a child or an adult or really any human being, that when their immune system is given the chance to adapt or overcome an infection in a natural way, that immune system is then stronger versus future infections? And then at the same time, if they're given a crutch or a vaccine, that effectively denies their immune system the ability to learn and adapt and thus makes them more susceptible to future infections.
There's some truth to what you said. I think I would frame that a little bit differently, in that vaccination is temporary immunity, if you even want to call it that. mean, vaccines have injected something that you develop an antibody that may or may not protect you. We really don't know. When you have the flu or if you have measles, you have mumps, you have chicken pox, your body has worked it out internally and has gone through the war and has won. And now the next time you get reintroduced to that virus or bacteria, the body says, I know what that's like. We're going to pick up a broom and get that out of here before it causes any problem. That's lifetime long-term immunity versus the temporary pseudo-immunity of vaccines. And because of the pseudo-immunity, now we're all developing booster shots because it doesn't last forever. We're also developing vaccines to take care of problems caused by vaccines. The chickenpox vaccine has eliminated the chickenpox virus out in the community, and so now because we don't have that virus around anymore, those of us that had chickenpox as children are going to be more susceptible to getting shingles as an adult. So now what have they done? They've created a shingles vaccine. So now we're creating vaccines to correct problems caused by vaccines.
Oh, fascinating. Well, there goes the never-ending chain of medical intervention. But what about this question? I'm sure you're asked this all the time. Doctors will say that vaccines are responsible for basically wiping out smallpox and polio, and they were a huge success. What's your answer to that?
My answer is it's another history lesson. When you look back historically, the smallpox was way going away before, even in the early 1970s. There was a spokesperson from the CDC, Dr. Tom Mack, who was one of the persons who had helped with the smallpox program from the CDC, who said that smallpox was way on its way out. It would have gone away anyways, even if we wouldn't have done a ring vaccination and containment, because it was going away with improved hygiene, improved health care, and improved living conditions. There are some estimates that less than 10 or 20% of the entire world population was ever vaccinated with the smallpox vaccine. It went away on its own. The same thing with the polio infections. The polio peaked and was way on its way out in this country before we instituted the polio vaccine in 1954. It was already on its way out. Worldwide, the only places that had the polio virus and still do, there are 11 countries that still do, are places that don't have flush toilets, don't have good hygiene, don't have ways to take care of the fecal materials that are in their communities. It's a hygiene issue. It's not a vaccine issue.
So why are health authorities so confident today that the vaccines were responsible for wiping these things out? I mean, is this just a propagation of a medical myth that they're sticking with? What's going on?
That's how I would answer that. I mean, you know, it's a good story. Stick to it.
Right. It sells more vaccines.
It's been working for a long time, and we've got, you know, when I do community talks, I was in Idaho in March and did a very large community talk, but there was a mixed age group in there. There were grandparents in there, there were people in their 40s, and there were some very young parents, and parents that were probably in their early 20s, and they were there with their little bitty babies that were just precious. So at one point I said, how many people in here that are over 40 had measles, mumps, chickenpox, things like that when they were kids? Every hand went up. I said, so on the break, I want you to commingle with these young parents over here and tell them what that was like. What was that experience like? What did you do? What did your parents do? Because young parents are terrified of these illnesses because they don't understand them. And once they start hearing that, you know, I mean, most of us didn't die, most of us had life, you know, it was just a rite of passage for a lot of people in their 40s and 50s, they don't have to be so fearful. And so much of this industry is absolutely just fear-driven.
It certainly is, and we're out of time here, Sherry, but I want to encourage listeners to check out your website one more time. That's www.sayingnotovaccines.com. Your book is also called Saying No to Vaccines. It's available on Amazon.com and other booksellers. So look for that if you'd like to learn more about vaccines and how to protect yourself and your family from vaccinations. You've been listening to an exclusive interview with Dr. Sherry Tenpenny. And check out my website, naturalnews.com, for a printed transcript of this entire interview. Thanks for joining me today, and we'll talk to you again soon.